Margaret Coon Campbell is a daughter of Peter McNab Coon, seventh and last owner of the Coal Harbor Dyke. Margaret Coon Campbell wrote a book called A Tale of Two Dykes, which was published in 1979. I will be doing a reading from this book, approximately pages 50 to 53. I have adapted and changed her words a bit for this reading. My name is Cindy Campbell Stone, no relation, and I am very honored to be reading the words of Margaret Coon Campbell. My father, Peter McNab Coon, intended to raise beef cattle on the marshes. The various species of grass would furnish food to grow cattle, if not to fatten them. The upland farm with its small grazing areas was supplementary. Beef that is raised, lean, and then fattened is good beef, young tissue and tender. So say my informants. Peter's career for the next 26 years was in this pursuit. It was never lucrative. Money was used for the necessities, with a few luxuries, but by supreme dedication and hard work on part of both parents, the family were raised in good health. As the owner of the dyke, Peter faced two challenges of special weight in a career which was constant challenge. One was the need to improve the sluice gates or abattoir so as to create better drainage from the harbor. He, being of inventive mind, had a plan for that which was carried out. My brother, well, he states from memory that the 8-foot-wide gates hung in the center of the 12-foot opening with rigid partitions 2 feet wide on either side, had become so waterlogged and heavy as to have lost their buoyancy and ability to float on the outgoing tide. They had also been faced with large copper plates as ballast to make them sink on the incoming flood. Peter took out the partitions, omitted the copper plates, and closed the whole width of each opening with a set of 2 gates, each 6 feet wide. The new system was better, and he was rewarded for his great effort. As Brother Wilfred puts it, he took the copper plates away and made larger gates, and that took the water out. The other challenge was a gauntlet thrown to my father every spring by the forces of nature in their damage to the abattoir. The frenzy of winter storms and the ice floes of the spring thaw pounding at the gates and their supporting woodwork always wrought some damage to the structure, sometimes with almost catastrophic injury. Gates would be torn off, buttress cribs injured. Once the eastern dyke was breached and cost 3 weeks of determined effort for its repair. The gates could usually be retrieved from the shore outside the harbor. They would be repaired and replaced. The cribs might need new planks and new rocks for fill. This work had to be done in early spring when the water was icy cold. And sometimes the emergency demanded that the worker wade in to reach his vantage point. My father must have reserved this duty for himself, as I've been told that he was seen standing up to his waist in the icy water. The men of the household, which means father and 2 sons, even when the boys were at a very tender age, would have to drive in the heavy farm wagon 8 slow miles by the West Lawrencetown Road to the abattoir, work all day according to the tide-governed opportunity, and return at night, often arriving late in the evening only to leave early the next morning for another hard day. Whatever the immediate demands were, in order to keep ahead of the destructive forces of wind and waves, these must be met by the human strength available. Occasionally, neighbors, the smaller marsh plot owners, helped with the repairs to the dike, but they were impressed by the boys' work. One of the tasks assigned to the boys was to collect rocks to replace those lost when crib work was damaged. They were proud when some of the men workers, observing the huge rocks which they brought and eyeing their puny strength, asked in amazement, "How did you lift them?" The boys' secret, their clever secret, well, they made a ramp of heavy planks to roll the rocks onto the wagon. You know, I was a little girl then, and I was never aware of the extremity of the hardships undergone by my father and brothers, well, until swept away by the discovery in a conversation recently with my one remaining brother, who is now living in Florida year-round. The scene is the cabana of his mobile home in Fort Lauderdale, with beautiful lawns and shrubs all around, and his own bananas, oranges, and papayas hanging from the trees. A great Chinese tulip was laden with blossoms, reaching its branches toward the sky and scattering pink petals on roof and lawn. Beautiful indeed. But you know, the reminiscing has been probing? Yeah, and evocative. The emotional strain greater than perhaps either realizes. Wilfred recalls something almost unbelievable to me. "We worked all day, drove the long road home, and reached there at 10 o'clock at night. We went to bed, and then we had to get up again at 4 o'clock in the morning to start." Unable to finish, he stands up and walks away, struggling to control an emotion which embarrasses him. No hint of bitterness is in these words, only sorrow for the little boy who used to be, and acceptance of the exigencies of the day. In retrospect, I envision our mother obliged to waken her young sons at such an unearthly hour and send them off to another of the long, unchildish experiences. All possible comforts of food and warm clothing she would, of course, provide, but she was powerless to combat such hardship for her boys. Wilfred, possibly 8 years old, and Max, the eldest of the family, at 13. The long struggle ended, perhaps mercifully, with an act of violence so rare in that long-ago peaceful rural era, the bombing, as it might be called, of the Abateau in 1917. But that is a story for another time.